You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Sin City Stories contains explicit content that may be disturbing to some listeners, including strong language, graphic details, and depictions of violent crimes. Listener discretion is advised. It's June 3rd, 1999, early morning, sometime around 5 a.m., in a quiet neighborhood roughly a mile from the Las Vegas Strip. Walking through this serene scene is a young man in his early 20s, draped in a camouflage shirt, sporting black pants and boots. In his hands, a pump-action shotgun loaded to maximum capacity. In his pockets are more shells, ready to be used, a total of 19 shells in all. The man's name is Zane Floyd, and on this early summer morning, he plans to use those 19 shells to kill the first 19 people he encounters. And as a resident of this neighborhood, he already knows exactly where his first stop will be. Since its founding on May 15, 1905, Las Vegas has gone from being a small railway stop in the middle of the Mojave Desert to a glittering neon oasis of gambling, shopping, fine dining, and entertainment, welcoming tens of millions of visitors from around the world every year. Through its relatively short history, the city has been witness to over a century's worth of murder, robberies, arson, and mayhem. And that's what we're here to share with you. In collaboration with mayheminthedesert.com, this is Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, the sordid tales behind the stranger-than-fiction history of fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. Zane Floyd was born in Estes Park, Colorado. Abandoned before birth by a biological father he'd never meet, Floyd was born 6 months premature, weighing less than 5 pounds, with underdeveloped lungs and suffering from FAS, or fetal alcohol syndrome. Throughout her pregnancy, Floyd's mother drank alcohol and abused drugs, including marijuana and possibly cocaine. Floyd faced delays in his early development, including walking and talking, and was actually held back in second grade. During elementary school, he was diagnosed with ADHD and prescribed Ritalin. While in middle school, Floyd was prescribed antidepressants to deal with his emotional issues, and doctors who treated Floyd at the time noted a history of lying, behavioral problems, and fighting with other children. In addition, Zane Floyd dealt with a very volatile home life, which intensified his problems at school. His mother was still a heavy drinker, as was his stepfather, Mike, who'd married Floyd's mother when he was just 3 years old. His stepfather was in the military, meaning Floyd moved frequently, and the family moved to Las Vegas when he was 12 years old. The Floyd family first lived in the Woodside Village apartments before moving into a house on West Oakey. Though the family settled in southern Nevada, Floyd's home life remained anything but settled. He and his mother were the frequent targets of physical abuse by Floyd's stepfather, which even resulted in at least one arrest. Predisposed to addiction, a condition brought on by his FAS, Floyd turned to alcohol to numb himself as he entered his teen years, and he eventually brought drugs into the picture, regularly smoking marijuana and using methamphetamines. Despite his problems, Zane Floyd did manage to find some successes. After being expelled from the public school system for suspected drug use and fighting on a school bus, Floyd was enrolled at a private religious school in western Las Vegas. There, Floyd improved his grades and even played on the school baseball team. However, those improvements didn't last, and Floyd went back to drinking and drugs. He returned to the public school system to try to graduate high school early, but ended up dropping out and had to face a future without a high school diploma. Zane Floyd had long held an interest in the military. Mike Floyd wanted his son to enlist in the Air Force or Navy, branches that could teach practical skills for civilian life, but Zane Floyd wanted to be a Marine. Floyd successfully made his way through boot camp and soon afterwards was deployed to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Though not in an active war zone, conditions on the base were harsh. Marines there faced an ever-present danger of being overrun by refugees, and they witnessed asylum seekers being shot by enemy soldiers or killed in the Cuban minefield outside the base. Following his time in Cuba, Floyd served as an instructor at Camp Pendleton in Southern California and was also stationed in South Carolina. Though he received several commendations through his service with the Marines, alcohol remained a problem for Zane Floyd. He was once disciplined for drinking on duty while in Cuba, again at Camp Pendleton, and he was charged with a DUI while stationed in South Carolina. When reenlistment time came, Floyd was told that due to his heavy drinking, he was no longer welcome in the Marines. He received an honorable discharge as a Lance Corporal in 1998. Floyd became listless after leaving the military, obtaining work as an armored car security guard and taking up residence in an apartment with friends who fueled his substance abuse habit. Floyd added the regular use of methamphetamine to his heavy drinking. Soon came habitual sleepless nights and, of course, plenty of partying. Chaos ruled Floyd's life by mid-1999. He lost his gig as a security guard, and all that he could find in lieu of this was a part-time gig as a bouncer for a local bar. That same month, a cousin with whom he was extremely close was killed by a drunk driver. Then came the kicker. He was evicted from his apartment and found himself living back with his parents in a guest house at their home off Oki Boulevard and Los Altos Street. Floyd allowed himself to believe the hopelessness he felt. Here he was in his early 20s without a purpose other than flittering from job to job and hanging out at the bars and strip clubs dotting the Vegas Valley. He did little to change his circumstances, but the one thing Floyd carried on with was his habit of over-consuming alcohol. Frustrated with his ability to only hold down short-term work, Floyd's anger grew. And that anger evolved into violence on the night of June 2, 1999. After picking up his final check from his security guard job, Zane Floyd and his girlfriend Paulina met up with friends at Sneakers Bar, where Floyd worked as a bouncer. They then made their way to Olympic Gardens, a gentleman's club on the north end of Las Vegas Boulevard, where Paulina's friends were having a bachelorette party. Floyd hit the booze hard at the strip club, part of an effort to numb the boiling anger he was consumed with when he realized he'd been shorted on his final paycheck. Floyd continued to drink, but not so much that he was unable to drive himself and Paulina over to the Rio Hotel, where the couple watched the band Boogie Nights perform in one of the lounges. At some point, though, Paulina got bored of being ignored while Floyd drank and hung out at the blackjack tables, and she left her inebriated partner alone in the casino. Floyd drank more and more, and then proceeded to gamble away most of that last short paycheck. He stumbled out of the Rio and into the backseat of a cab. Before long, he was back at his parents' home, where he proceeded to consume still more booze while listening to music. Anyone who grew up in Las Vegas in the pre-internet age remembers the vast section of the local Yellow Pages dedicated to entertainment. This part of the phone book featured page after page of exotic dancer and escort advertisements. Floyd called a company called Lovebound, one of the many options available. And although he only had $7 to his name, he told the operator he had $700, an amount that usually indicated a client was interested in more than just a private dance. 20-year-old Tracy Carter, who worked under the name Kayla, was sent to Floyd's location. She arrived at Floyd's parents' home at around 3:30 a.m. on the morning of June 3, 1999. Floyd rushed the woman inside and slammed the door behind her. When she turned around, Floyd had a 12-gauge shotgun pointed directly at her. With a look that stared right through her, Floyd then demanded Carter to undress. When she balked at his demands, Floyd informed her that the weapon in his hands could put a hole in her the size of a fist. Floyd then placed handcuffs on Carter and sexually assaulted her. Floyd proceeded to tell Carter that he had 19 shotgun shells and he planned to kill the next 19 people he saw. She felt terror as Floyd lovingly caressed the shotgun and told her the firearm was his baby. Floyd mused to Carter about his next steps. He said that if someone came knocking at the door, he'd shoot her so that she wouldn't have to witness his suicide. Assuming that Floyd would take her life at the end of the ordeal, Carter was shocked when Floyd told her to get out of his house. Without giving Floyd an opportunity to reconsider, the young woman darted from the home and headed to a friend's house. Night still hung over the Vegas Valley as Zane Floyd loaded his 12-gauge shotgun and considered ending his life right there in his small bedroom. But Floyd didn't choose suicide. Instead, he donned pseudo-military apparel and covered himself in a bathrobe. He tucked the shotgun underneath his robe and filled his spacious pockets with shotgun shells. Floyd then left his parents' house and began the 15-minute walk to the Albertsons grocery store at the shopping center on the northwest corner of Sahara and Valley View. The one thought dominating Floyd's mind at that moment was his desire to know what it was like to shoot and kill someone. And to accomplish that end, Floyd wanted to find a place with a lot of people. Strolling along the border of Vegas Verdes Elementary School, Floyd passed quiet houses where most people were still sleeping. He then walked in front of the Happy Days daycare that sat next to a parking lot where pedestrians could cut through to enter the Albertsons shopping center. Floyd walked through a nearly empty parking lot, passing the closed Dairy Queen and Dead Poets used bookstore, as he made his way towards the illuminated doors of the Albertsons. Approximately 30 people, made up of employees and customers, were in the store as the young man with a shaved head and shotgun underneath his robe steadily advanced. Floyd wanted to go to the closest crowded place he could find to take as many human lives as he could. But as his target came into view, Floyd asked himself, "Are you going to do this or what?" He decided the answer was yes. At approximately 5:15 a.m., Zane Floyd entered the Albertsons and encountered 40-year-old Thomas Darnell pushing shopping carts just inside the entrance. From a distance of about 15 feet, Floyd fired into Darnell's back. For the next several minutes, Floyd calmly made his way through the supermarket, firing at two employees near the intersection of aisles 7 and 14. Cutting down Dennis Sargent and store manager Carlos Leos. After the first three murders, Floyd spotted 21-year-old Zachary Emmenegger, who bolted for safety when he saw the shotgun pointed in his direction. Diving under a produce table, Emmenegger avoided Floyd's gunfire for 15 full seconds before ultimately being shot in the upper chest, resulting in a punctured lung. Floyd then saw Emmenegger move and shot him again. As Floyd approached, Emmenegger remained still. Believing Emmenegger deceased, Floyd whispered, "Yeah, you're dead," and he went on the hunt for more victims. Eventually, Floyd discovered Lucy Tarantino, another employee in the rear of the store. Floyd sprinted after Tarantino and cornered her on the west side of the store.
Floyd ignored Tarantino's pleas for mercy and murdered the woman with a single shot.
More than 20 other employees and customers survived that day by hiding throughout the store, including inside food coolers and dark back rooms. Less than a minute after Floyd had entered the Albertsons, the store's bookkeeper, Christine Goldsworthy, had called 911 while hiding in an upstairs office that overlooked the store. Police were there in minutes, but by then, it was too late. 4 people were dead, and 1 was severely injured. At roughly 5:20 a.m., just 5 minutes after he'd arrived, with no potential victims remaining, Floyd walked out the front door of the store, where he encountered several Metro Police cars that had sped to the scene. Floyd ran back inside the store for a few seconds before re-emerging with his shotgun held to his chin. "Shoot me!" Floyd begged of the officers gathered around him with their weapons drawn, but after several minutes of tense negotiations, Floyd agreed to put down his weapon and be taken into custody. As he was put in the back of a patrol car, still reeking of alcohol, Floyd appeared distraught, in disbelief of what he'd done.
"Why did I kill those people? Why did I kill those people? I don't know."
Floyd was stuttering and hyperventilating as he spoke with the officers interrogating him.
"I don't know why. I don't know why. I just started shooting, and I just kept shooting."
When Floyd's blood alcohol level was tested at 8 a.m., or roughly 3 hours after being arrested, it came out at a 0.09. According to experts who would later testify at his trial, that meant it was likely up around a 0.14 at the time of the shooting. The blood test also found no traces of drugs, even though Floyd had claimed to have taken meth prior to the rampage at the Albertsons. From the onset of the case, prosecutors made it clear they wanted capital punishment for the quadruple killer and filed a notice that they intended to seek the death penalty 1 month after Zane Floyd's arrest. The prosecution, led by Clark County District Attorney Stuart Bell, argued that Floyd's crime was premeditated and deliberate. This was a calculated, cold-blooded killing spree. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew it would end with people dead. Bell urged the jury to impose the death penalty, citing the heinousness of the crime and the overwhelming evidence of Floyd's intent to murder. Floyd's defense team never disputed their client's guilt, but argued that his mental state at the time of the shooting should be considered during the trial. Floyd's attorneys pointed to his history of depression, excessive alcohol consumption, and PTSD stemming from his time in the military. They argued that Floyd was deeply troubled and that his psychological issues had played a significant role in the attack. Floyd himself expressed remorse for the killings, and his defense lawyers fought to spare him from the death penalty, arguing for mercy. Defense attorney Curtis Brown stated, "Zane Floyd is not a monster. He's a young man who's struggled with severe emotional problems, and those problems drove him to commit this terrible crime." Despite the defense's efforts, Floyd was convicted of 4 counts of first-degree murder, sexual assault for his attack on Tracy Carter, and multiple counts of attempted murder. This verdict came as no surprise to the defense. They knew the real battle would be fought during the penalty phase of the case against Zane Floyd. During the sentencing phase, prosecutors once again pressed for Floyd to receive the death penalty. They argued that the premeditated nature of the crime, combined with the sheer brutality of the killings, made the death penalty the only just outcome. District Attorney Bell underscored that Floyd had left a suicide note for his family before the shooting, indicating he fully anticipated either dying or being arrested for his actions. Bell told the jury, "This was a man who went out with the intention of causing as much pain and suffering as possible." Meanwhile, the defense continued to stress Floyd's mental health issues and military background. His attorneys presented testimony from mental health experts who stated that Floyd was suffering from PTSD and depression, which may have clouded his judgment. They urged the jury to consider life in prison without parole as a more appropriate punishment, particularly in light of Floyd's remorse and acknowledgement of his crimes. Defense attorney Brown said, "Zane Floyd has shown remorse and regret. Executing him will not bring back the lives lost. It will only add another death to the toll." Ultimately, the jury sided with the prosecution. In July of 2000, Zane Floyd was sentenced to death for his crimes. But despite this sentence, Zane Floyd's execution has been delayed for over 2 decades. Floyd's legal team has filed numerous appeals over the years, arguing that the death penalty is unconstitutional and that executing someone with a mental illness violates international human rights standards. One of the most significant arguments raised by his attorneys has been the evolving understanding of mental health and the criminal justice system's responsibility to take these factors into account. Additionally, delays in Floyd's execution have been fueled by broader debates over the methods of execution. Nevada, where Floyd remains on death row, has faced difficulties in obtaining the drugs needed for lethal injection. Also, the state has struggled with drug manufacturers who have refused to supply lethal injection drugs for executions, citing ethical concerns. As a result, the state of Nevada has been unable to carry out scheduled executions, including Zane Floyd's, without facing legal challenges from pharmaceutical companies and anti-death penalty organizations. Floyd's execution was scheduled several times in the 2010s and early 2020s, but each time, stays of execution were granted due to either appeals or logistical issues. The tale of Zane Floyd and the horrible crime he committed is a bit different for Sin City Stories in that there's a personal connection to this story. Anthony Smith, one of the co-creators of Mayhem in the Desert and co-producer of this podcast, grew up across the street from Vegas Verdes Elementary School, across the street from where Zane Floyd was residing the day he made the walk to the local supermarket with a shotgun in hand. Anthony would later recount that one of the eeriest experiences of his early adolescence came as he was inside the Albertsons for the first time after the massacre. The aisles were organized the same and the store appeared unchanged. But as he walked through the produce section, Anthony couldn't help but imagine Zachary Emmenegger desperately dodging for cover to avoid Floyd's shotgun blasts, or hearing the voice of Lucy Tarantino begging to be spared, pleading for her life. And this time, when Anthony and his grandparents left the store after the weekly shopping, there was no Thomas Darnell to walk them out and help load the groceries into the trunk of their Lincoln that was missing an L, which Thomas jokingly referred to as a top-of-the-line Incan. What might be just a supermarket to others had served as Anthony's neighborhood grocery store for as long as he could remember, and Floyd's murderous actions had transformed this familiar physical location into something else. Something dark. During Zane Floyd's murder trial, the district attorney called the crime the worst massacre in the history of Las Vegas. Since that mass shooting at an Albertsons in a quiet Las Vegas neighborhood, these tragedies have become even more commonplace in the United States, with the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history occurring right on the Vegas Strip, less than 5 miles from where Zane Floyd unleashed his uncategorized rage. Over 25 years have passed since that June morning, and Zane Floyd is still alive, continuing to serve his time at Ely State Prison, a maximum security prison in Ely, Nevada, roughly 250 miles north of Las Vegas. To learn more about this Las Vegas true crime story and many others, visit mayheminthedesert.com and get yourself acquainted with the darker side of Sin City's history. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is based on material researched and written by Megan and Anthony Smith and is adapted for podcast, edited, and narrated by Jeff Walker. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is a co-production of Mayhem in the Desert and Walker New Media. Copyright 2024.